Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego respectfully declined the king's offer to bow down to his image. And it's at this point, he doesn't recognize, obviously, God, despite having professed the God that they serve in the previous chapter, and going to do so again here in just a few moments. He doesn't recognize this as their respect for God. Rather, he sees this only as their defiance and their disrespect to him, greatest king in the entire world. He sees their defiance. And he makes this statement. Anybody reading from the New King James? I think we've got several here that study from that. And as I was looking through some information, and as I looked through that rendition, I thought, well, that has to be a mistake. You see Nebuchadnezzar's response to them. He says, heat it up 1 7 times. That's how the King James Version, not the new, but the original King James, translates that. So I had to figure out, well, what does that mean? That's surely a mistake, 1 7. But it just simply really is an idiom that he uses to say 1 multiplied by 7. And it's a phrase that would have been recognized back then. Essentially what he's telling these people, to heat up the furnace as hot as you can make it. So you can see there, as he sees their defiance, he sees their refusal to bow down, he's angered because of that, and he wants to make an example of these people so that no one questions his authority whenever he speaks. His word is to be law. And what probably would have happened, they would have brought in these huge bellows that they would have used to pump air into this furnace, causing it to heat up significantly. What you would have had is the fire, the mouth of the fire where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are going to be thrown into. You would have had flames jumping out of that entrance because of the excessive air that was being brought in as the furnace was heated up. You can almost imagine Nebuchadnezzar as he's heating this furnace up. And these men said, no, we're not going to bow down. He says, okay, heat it up 7 times hotter than it already is. And they bring in these bellows and they start pumping air. And the flames are jumping out. You can almost imagine him watching Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, seeing if they're going to have some sort of visible reaction or maybe some repentance when they realize that he's serious about throwing them in. It doesn't faze them. They've given their answer. They say, you can throw us in, you can kill us, we're not going to bow down. So as this fire heats up, the entrance would have become unapproachable. In fact, that's what we see happening whenever the guards then take Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and it says it was his mighty men. So his courageous and valiant men of his army, they are the ones that take Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They throw them in, and whenever they get that close to the mouth of the fire, the ones that are throwing them in die. So you can see his urgency. You can see his anger. You can see that erratic personality that we've talked about as we looked in chapter 2 coming out again. You know, these courageous, mighty men, he's not caring about their life. He simply wants to make an example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And if it costs him some of his best men to do it, so be it. He's going to make an example of these people. And so they're standing there at the mouth of the fire. They throw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in. The ones that cast them into the fire devours them, and they die. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, then Daniel lets us know as he's writing this, they're not there on the outskirts of the fire. They roll down into the fire, into the hottest part. They were going to be bound up, tied together. According to Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, I'm sure, he was thinking they were going to be dead by the time they hit the bottom. But that's not what we find out. As they fall into this furnace, what we see is the deliverance of God. And Nebuchadnezzar finds himself, I believe, here in quite a dilemma. His expectations was that these three men would have been burned to bits, dead before they hit the bottom. His mighty men die as they approach the entrance. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're going to be just as dead, just as immediately. And kind of the scene that I think Daniel portrays here, you see Nebuchadnezzar, he's off at a safe distance. He's nowhere near the mouth of this furnace. But he's sitting there watching as these three men are being executed here in this fire. His response upon seeing them thrown in and then looking up and seeing this, it says that the king was astonished. The word used to describe that is giving us the idea that he had become alarmed by what he saw. And it's in haste that he then jumps up and points out to his advisors and those that are standing around. The language here suggests that there was somewhat of an element of fear in Nebuchadnezzar's response to seeing what he saw after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown in. Can you think why he might be afraid?
Well, you just saw one miracle, right?
Yeah.
So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego weren't burned up, but the mighty men were.
Yeah.
So immediately there's something not right.
Something not right. Exactly. He's seen a miracle. He's witnessed once again the power of God in a very observable and powerful way. Why do you think he might have been afraid after seeing that? What did he just previously said?
He's always felt that he's all powerful.
control.
Right? He thought he was the one in control. He thought he was taking their life. Verse 15, remember, he essentially aligns himself against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and challenges them. He says, you bow down whenever these instruments play. If you don't, I'm going to throw you into this furnace. And who is the God that's going to save you then? He challenges the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He throws them into the furnace. They aren't killed. He's openly opposed to God that they serve. They're thrown in this furnace. He sees a fourth person walking around. What do you think might be in the back of his mind? I've just challenged this God, if you will, openly insulting him, openly questioning his power. And here he is. You know, I expect these men to be dead, but here he is. They're walking around, and there's somebody in there with them. And so you can imagine perhaps why he was fearful, why he jumped up in haste and says to his advisors, you know, what's that I see in the fire? He's rashly pronounced judgment against these men. He's challenged their God to deliver them. Their God has answered. And now I'm sure he can't help but wonder, has his proud boast unsettled the heavens themselves? Think back to Herod in the book, or think forward to Herod in the book of Acts. You remember as he's there and he's given this great oration, and the people are praising him and saying, the voice of a God, not of a man. God hears that and God's angered. Remember what God does? Struck him with a disease, and he died. You anger the God of heaven, the results are not oftentimes going to be favorable for you. And so no doubt Nebuchadnezzar, as he sees those men, he can't believe his eyes. And he asks his advisors, those that are around him, for confirmation. He says, did we not cast in three men? Now, their response, you can look at this a couple of ways. Some people have suggested, when you look at Nebuchadnezzar's response to throwing Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the fire, he's astonished. He jumps up. He's fearful. He's alarmed at what he sees. But then he asks his advisors, did we not throw in three men? Their response seems to be less anxious than his. They just say, yes, O king, it was three men that we threw in. Some have suggested that perhaps Nebuchadnezzar was the only one that had witnessed what was actually taking place there. And that rather his advisors, than being perhaps as alarmed and as surprised as seeing these men walking around in the fire, seeing the fourth man, the fourth form that was there, and maybe because it was Nebuchadnezzar who issued this challenge against God, that perhaps he was the only one that was actually seeing what was taking place. It's not really terribly relevant. But you do see, I believe, the lack of surprise in the voice of the advisors whenever they reply to Nebuchadnezzar. You know, we threw in three men. They don't seem to be as caught off guard. But
verse 27 though says that they witnessed it.
Well, it says they saw these men on whose body the fire had no power. You know, they saw that the effect was that, you know, and we'll get over there in just a second, that the fire didn't touch them, right?
You know, what you're saying, that some people think that maybe they wasn't actually witnessing or watching it, but they were.
They saw that. Yeah. But, you know, you remember, God is communicating.
Did you turn it off? Somebody forgot to turn it off.
That was me. I told James I was going to start filling up the baptistry. And I told him, I promise I'm going to leave that thing running because my memory for things like that is terrible. And he saved us. So here, this would have put out the fiery furnace. We'll be okay, y'all. But once that thing overflows, thank you for stopping that. But you know, God has in times past shown certain things to certain people. You remember Elisha the prophet as he's surrounded there and his little servant Gehazi's with him. He's surrounded by the Assyrian army. And Elisha sees what's going on. He sees this spiritual army outside of the Assyrians that Gehazi's unable to see, and he asks God to open his eyes and let Gehazi see that, you know, they're not surrounded by the Assyrians, rather the Assyrians are surrounded by God's army. And it's of course, it's like Dick was saying, there's nothing in here that we can use to validate that, but God's done this before. He's going to do this again. And this is just what some have supposed, and it's not really relevant. The point being, as you might see it brought in verse 27, that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were saved from this terrible death, and that those who were around witnessed their salvation to some degree. Now, whether they saw what Nebuchadnezzar saw, perhaps, whether they didn't, perhaps that's the case as well. But they saw Nebuchadnezzar issue this challenge. They saw God's deliverance. They saw these three men after they had come out of the fire. There wasn't any smell of smoke. They were in their clothes. Obviously, there was some divine intervention that had protected them from the judgment of King Nebuchadnezzar. Dave?
I think it's funny that what you see in Nebuchadnezzar's
Mm-hmm.
He made the edict. He's the one that challenged God. And then when it all comes down and starts going wrong, he says, hey, didn't we throw those guys in there?
Yeah, that's kind of true. It wasn't just him anymore. He realized he wasn't the biggest kid on the playground anymore, didn't he? When he sees what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's got. So he sees from this his response when he's telling them what I see in verse 25. He says, I see four men. Rather than the three corpses he would have expected when Shadrach, Meshach hit that furnace and the fire got a hold of them. This is what gets his attention. He sees not just three, but he's four. They're no longer bound, but rather they're loose. Previously, to prevent escape, they'd been tied up, as Daniel tells us. And they weren't tied up and capable of moving around. He says, they're in the furnace and they're walking around. They're not screaming in pain. They're not screaming in agony, being burned to death. They're not even trying to escape. Rather, they're just walking about in the midst of the furnace. We see that they were also uninjured. Obviously, something extraordinary, something miraculous, something divine is taking place. And in verse 4, the last thing he says there, the fourth person that he sees is like the Son of God. Now, this rendition, the New King James and the King James Version, of what Nebuchadnezzar's saying here can be somewhat confusing. I've seen some perhaps come along and say, well, Nebuchadnezzar here is recognizing, and whether this fourth being was Jesus or not, that's not really relevant. That's not anything that we can determine or ascertain by the text. But a lot of people want to take, undoubtedly, what Nebuchadnezzar's saying here and saying that he's talking about Jesus. Well, we know enough about Nebuchadnezzar to know that, first and foremost, he doesn't just solely worship God. In fact, he's not really done much more than acknowledge Jehovah God, the Father. So he wouldn't know. He wouldn't have the knowledge to know. The Son isn't manifested for us until the New Testament. So how would Nebuchadnezzar, just as he's speaking here in haste about what he sees, be able to all of a sudden on his own acknowledge this fourth being as Jesus, the Son of God? Some have looked at that and said that he's talking about Jesus, the Son of God. Really what he's doing in the best translation for us is he's describing him as a son of the gods. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, being polytheistic, worshiping a multiplicity of gods, says that this form of this fourth one that's walking around, that's protecting these men, obviously, is like a divine form. It's like a son of the gods. And so what he's doing is he's describing this being not as Jesus, but rather as some form of deity, some form of divinity that's causing them to be protected and to be saved during this situation.
Could, American Standard does say the son of the gods.
Okay, and that's your more accurate rendition. And anyone here have an ESV that they use? ESV, I don't know what it says. It probably would lean more toward the sons of the gods, which is, I believe, the son of the gods. So ESV, New American Standard, both of those translate this phrase of what Nebuchadnezzar has said as son of the gods. So the point being, he's not saying this is Jesus. Jesus isn't made manifest until the New Testament. We're not told about the Word becoming flesh and walking on the earth until the revelation of the New Testament. So for Nebuchadnezzar to know and to say that this was Jesus, the Son of God, is too bold of a presumption. Miss Johnny? Right. So, you know, as if that weren't enough, as if the language wasn't enough, he doesn't, you know, if he would have been referring to the Son of God, he wouldn't have called Jesus that. So it's pretty obvious. He just is saying this form of this other one is divine. So that's what we see there.
Back in Job 1 and 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves. And mine had a reference back to that.
Right. That's kind of the council there. And whether it was or not, that's, you know, we don't know. But he's definitely not. Nebuchadnezzar is saying, hey, this is the Son of God. He doesn't believe in God as in Jehovah, so he wouldn't attribute to that. Rather, it's the Son of the gods. He's divine. But let's stop just a moment. Look at question four. There's a passage in the New Testament, and it's very short, but you may know which one it is. Can you think of a New Testament passage that refers to this event here, salvation from the fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego?
Hebrews
11:25. Okay. Is it 11:25? Okay. But yes, that is the correct place, the book of Hebrews chapter 11. That hall of faith And you may remember as the authors, he's listed some specific examples, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Abel, Noah, and several others. He says, time would fail me to tell of everyone that should be included in here. And he lists off some of the courageous deeds that those people of faith had performed in times past. What was the reference to these that he made? What had these men done? Verse 24 tells us, what did they do? What does the Hebrew writer say that these men did?
Verse 34 says, quench the violence of fire.
Okay. So, and that's a clear allusion to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You can go up to the previous, before quenching the violence of fire, stop the mouths of lions. You know who he's talking about there. And so along that same chord, you've got Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego also in the same book that have quenched the violence of fire. So I'd like to stop for just a moment and kind of put a hold on this. We'll get to the rest of the chapter, the last portion, in just a bit. I'd like to discuss a work called The Song of the Three Holy Children for just a moment. It's in the Septuagint translation, the Syriac, the Arabic, and the Latin Vulgate. And there are these 68 verses containing what is called the Song of the Holy Children. It's not in Aramaic, which is the original, if you'll remember. It's not in the original text. But in various translations, this document is included in this portion of Daniel. And I bring this up because I remember hearing, just whenever I was younger, of an apocryphal writing that was part of the book of Daniel. And this is what it's referencing here. Now, you know, may know about the apocryphal, that it's not included within the inspired canon. There are some Bibles, and I believe perhaps the Catholic Bible, that includes a lot of the apocryphal writings would include this specific writing. You know, I've talked a little bit about before what would take place. People would come along, and after an event occurred, it may be hundreds and hundreds of years, and these were perhaps thought to be written during post-AD times. You know, they would come along, and they would write their own thoughts, perhaps as an addendum to something that was originally written by an inspired man. And just through the process of time, these Jewish writings would be accumulated and be associated with another book. And that's where we have this Song of the Three Holy Children. So during the Hellenistic era, some writers were motivated to write these things to expand upon the original text. And that's what we have here in the Song of the Three Holy Men. So I'd like to read an excerpt from that just to kind of share that with you and to broaden your perhaps view of this. Please understand, this is in no way considered inspiration under the inspiration of God. Rather, it was written much later. But it does kind of help us understand, because you may come across someone that knows of these. And it's interesting to see some of the things that are said, the things that are portrayed, just as they're handed down. You know, Jewish tradition was handed down by mouth oftentimes. And so perhaps these are some of the stories that were used to make this more exciting, to give more detail about this specific event where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are walking around. And I'll just read a few of the verses I've got there on the screen so you can get an idea and a feel for this text. They walked about in the midst of the flames, singing hymns to God and blessing the Lord. Then Azariah stood and offered his prayer in the middle of the fire. He opened his mouth and said, Blessed art thou, O Lord, God of our fathers, and worthy of praise. And thy name is glorified forever. For thou art all in all, just as thou hast done to us, and all thy works are true, and thy ways right, and all thy judgments are truth. Thou hast executed both judgments and all that thou hast brought upon us, and upon Jerusalem, the holy city of our fathers. For in truth and justice thou hast brought all this upon us because of our sins. And you're going to notice that's very similar to a prayer that Daniel's going to say, I believe it's in chapter 9, somewhere later in the book. In verses 23 through 25, Azariah concluded his prayer, if you will. And this is additional writing that follows. Now the king's servants who threw them in did not cease feeding the furnace fires with naphtha, pitch, tow, and brush. And the flames streamed out above the furnace 49 cubits, and it broke through and burned those of the Chaldeans whom it caught about the fire. But the angel of the Lord came down into the furnace to be with Azariah and his companions, and drove the fiery flame out of the furnace, and made the mist of the furnace like a moist whistling wind, so the fire did not touch them at all, or hurt or trouble them. Then the three men, as with one mouth, praised and glorified and blessed God, in the furnace. And so that's just a small excerpt there from the 68 verses, this apocryphal text that's referred to the Psalms of the Three Holy Children. And you can tell that it doesn't really follow. The writing that we read here is not found in the Aramaic in the original. Just wanted to offer that to you for your consideration, as I personally found that interesting. But be aware, that's an apocryphal work written outside of when the book of Daniel was known to have been written, written hundreds of years later, and just through Jewish tradition associated by some of them with the original work. So I just wanted to take and share that with you. And if you ever hear anyone talking about an apocryphal portion of Daniel, that's what they're going to be referring to, the Song of the Three Holy Children and the Song of Azariah. Okay, let's conclude there with the last few verses of the chapter. Dick, would you read for us verses 28 through 30?
Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angels and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word, and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut into pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Thank you, Dick. So we see Nebuchadnezzar praising, once again, as he'd previously done, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I'd like to get to this last question. There's nothing terribly that we'll miss by just looking at the last question that I've got. I'd rather stimulate some discussion, as I believe this passage here is relatively clear. But you see the big bully, as Dave described, and I think that's very apt. Yeah, he's humbled. He realizes now that he's spoken out of turn. And as a result of that, he speaks in such a way, I believe, as he's trying to appease the God that he might have otherwise offended. So let's look at question 5 and perhaps get some discussion, and we'll close with this thought. What are some lessons Christians today can learn from Daniel's 3 friends?
Remain faithful no matter what
the trial. Okay. Faithfulness regardless of what we find ourselves facing.
Only one true God.
Okay, there's only one true God. Nebuchadnezzar's, he's realizing that. It's going to be a process of learning for him. He could have caught on back earlier in chapter 2 whenever the vision was interpreted. He definitely should have caught on right here. But once again, he just kind of acknowledges, you know, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, God of gods. That doesn't exclude all others, but he should have realized here after this display of power by Jehovah God that all of his gods, as he said, paled in comparison to his own power. They were non-existent, but Jehovah was capable of saving. Dave?
I would say get ready, be ready, and stay ready.
That's a good point. Very concise. You know, get ready, and that's what we see these three young men doing back in chapter 1. They prepared themselves, and they stayed ready. You know, Daniel wasn't around, it doesn't appear, to be the leader, to be the initiator, to say we're not bowing down, or to rescue them perhaps because of his power and influence. They were ready. They'd gotten ready. They stayed ready. You never know what you're going to face. You never know what sort of challenge or temptation or trial that God may place in front of you. And for these men, it was the worst. It was their life that was on the line. Yet even with their life in the balance, even with their life on the line, they chose service to God. They chose to remain faithful. Anyone else have anything they'd like to share? Okay, so I believe there are an abundance of lessons here and throughout the course of our time, and I think this is our 3rd week, which we'll be bringing chapter 3 to a close. We've learned some good things from them and from their example. And so once again, you know, these are young men that have demonstrated faith to God in a most very turbulent time, and I think that they're a good example for us as well. So we'll pick up next week in chapter 4, and I'm going to try to have those questions ready by Wednesday night. So we'll probably continue to follow a similar path. I know we've transitioned a couple times from verse to verse and then from section to section. Questions throughout and questions at the end, but I'm trying to find, I believe, a more consistent pattern. So we'll continue our discussion much the same way as we've been looking at a group of texts all at once. Then having questions interspersed throughout, having discussion. Anyone have any thoughts, comments, questions that they'd like to bring to our attention as we bring chapter 3 to a close? Robert?
I can't help but think that God purposely slew those soldiers that were pushing them into the fire. Maybe they just pushed on their mm-hmm. own death, but I think that's another reason Nebuchadnezzar was quite frightened. Okay. He just slew the instruments of their death, and he was the cause of the death, so he was
true. True. That could very much be an influence on why he was so afraid. You know, the greatest men in Nebuchadnezzar's army died, and maybe perhaps at the hands of God. God saved these men. Obviously, he could kill those that were going to be the executioners for the three Jews. And so, since these great mighty men of Nebuchadnezzar's had died, God killed them, or they died. These three men were saved. What was God going to do to him? Maybe he was going to cause flames to jump out from the fire and consume Nebuchadnezzar as well, as he'd done with these three men, or the men that threw in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Well, we don't know. He had a very good reason, though, to be afraid, insulting the God of heaven. Who's the God that will save you? And then God showing you, it's me. I'll show you. I'll save them. So he was very right to be afraid. But we'll see if it sinks in. We get here later into the chapter, chapter 4, actually. We'll see Nebuchadnezzar's pride once again manifests itself in this failure to really learn. And